Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Thursday, January 21st, 2016.
Wait for it.
I was the big buildup. What year is it today? Awesome, wonderful, smart Alec voice belongs to John Martellaro. How are you, John?
Smart Alec, yeah, I guess. Good morning.
It's great to have you here. And Dave Hamilton, how are you?
I am here. It is also 2016.
Awesome. Well, you know, we are in different time zones, so it's good to check.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading yesterday about quantum entanglement across time instead of space. Scary stuff.
Huh. Also, that actually sounds interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I can't wait to see your article about that, John.
It's convenient to...
We'll get Lisa Randall on background mode and have her explain it.
Convenient to have to consider time as a constant, right? And a predictable concept. But I firmly believe that time is far more abstract than we care to perceive.
And squishy and relative.
It's a big ball of wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we don't even perceive time as a constant. We just refer to it that way. But our perception of time is never constant and consistent.
Right.
Right.
Right. Which yes.
So this went deeper than you folks thought, huh?
Yeah. And
notice how Martellaro got us off on a physics track right away.
Hey, I'm in.
I'm in. And I was about to take us way down that quantum rabbit hole. But instead of doing that, how about if I take us down a different rabbit hole? And this is the rabbit
hole. What if we say we did go down the quantum rabbit hole? And if you missed it, you just need to get in sync.
There you go. I love it. Yes, that's exactly what happened. Okay, so now
returning from the quantum physics discussion.
Yeah. Okay. So your go-to loop brought you back here. Welcome back, everyone. The first thing post quantum entanglement that I want to discuss is what one of the things that happened with the iOS 9.2.1 update. So there was a lot of security stuff in there. One of the things that was fixed was this issue where a hacker could essentially hijack your mobile web browser sessions through the cookies that have been set on your iPhone or your iPad. And so once they have done that, then they can route you through into their own accounts to do whatever they want. They can take over your accounts depending on what type of services you're using. And it's a really good thing that this is fixed. Even though right now there are no known issues in the wild. But the thing is, this is something that was reported to Apple 2.5 years ago. And it just now got fixed. And I'm curious, what's your take on this, guys?
Dave?
Wow. John, you and I have very different perceptions or choices that we make about security. Security falls on a continuum, I always say, right? Between convenience, the ultimate convenience, and ultimate security.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of stuff doesn't freak me out. I tend to live on the more convenient side, but that doesn't excuse Apple from ignoring this. But you know, I mean, we're even using that word ignoring. We're projecting here because clearly they didn't completely ignore it. They eventually addressed it. It took them a long time.
Mm-hmm. 2.5 years.
But nothing bad happened in the interim.
Ah, yes, and I want to talk about that.
So, you know, what – there's a lot of and that's the thing, right, is we could say like what I have not yet done at my home is put an entire layer of bricks completely around the house, sealing up all the windows and doors, right? I could, And it would make my home more secure than it is now with windows that people can see in and perhaps break into and doors that people can open. But I haven't done that. So, you know, there's this thing like where is that line? Where is it most important to put my efforts? And perhaps, you know, for me, my efforts are more along the lines of, well, I'm going to pick the right neighborhood to live in so that I don't have to worry about this.
Let's face it, Dave. We have sort of a hair trigger mentality. Brian Chaffin brought that up in the pre-show. And so we're kind of at a distance. We don't know the intimate technical details of iOS. We're not developers. We just go by word of mouth and opinion and impression. And so when we hear about a technical exploit, we tend to think, oh, it's terrible. Oh, it's going to happen immediately. It's like somebody's going to break in tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
And then it goes for years. And it turns out that there may be technical issues with the operating system and implementing it. It may be that an implementation of the hack in real world is more difficult than the person who first discovered it might imagine through a proof of concept of development.
Yeah.
And then Apple does a technical assessment of it and says, well, this is down on the priority list. We have bigger fish to fry right now.
That's it. Yeah. We want our users. I mean, you know, to extend my house analogy, I like to be able to see out my windows, right? You know, so Apple likes their users to have certain functionality. I mean, we could and have had and will have the argument that Apple sometimes limits the user's functionality. But there are certain functions that Apple likes their users to have.
Well, even more important than that, sometimes fixing these security flaws that are discovered that are conceptual turns out that you may require fundamental changes to the way the operating system works or the way even cookies work and violate standards.
Maybe we needed iOS 9 to be the foundation for this fix, and then they were able to kind of go and address it.
But that happens a lot. That's right? A good point. It's a good point.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of times where on our, you know, on like our servers, I've been managing Unix servers, and iOS 9 is a Unix-based operating system, or a Unix operating system.
BSD, actually.
Yes, correct. That's right. Yep.
And Android is Linux, if people didn't know that. Some people don't believe Android is Linux, but it is through and through.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is, like, there have been times where we've had to either do a kernel update to address a security flaw, or we've had to come up with a workaround, or we've had to kind of do an evaluation and say, hey, it's not worth doing a kernel update to fix that security flaw. We're not doing things that would leave us susceptible to that in a remarkable way. And a kernel update can break all kinds of other things.
Yes.
So moving from iOS 8 to iOS 9 or even iOS 7 to iOS 8 to iOS 9, those are kernel updates, right? And so there's a lot of things, like to your point, John, we don't know what it took to fix this. We could find out, right? But Apple, you know, I don't mean to be an Apple apologist here, but when it comes to security, they're kind of crazy.
They do a very good job.
I think they do.
You hear about all these exploits that are conceptual, but you don't often hear about people who've had real problems. I mean, we would cover those stories if, you know, John X in Des Moines, Iowa had his Mac broken into and all his stuff stolen from some predator in Czech Republic, you know, so... We don't hear too many of those stories. We hear about Apple making it very difficult for a woman to get her husband's password after he passed away and requiring a court order. We hear about the behind the scenes in X-Protect, where Apple disables certain apps and so on. We hear about SIP and El Capitan and all the things that Apple's doing. And then all of a sudden we get bitter when we hear about an exploit that hasn't been fixed in a while, and we get all crazy about it. But as we said, 2.5 years, Dave, and nothing happened. It must have been really hard to exploit in the wild, or to implement in the wild.
Well, to implement in the wild, what you have to do is create a Wi-Fi network. That's open, so anyone can join it.
Coffee shop. Okay. Step one.
And then once that's happened, then what you're doing is exploiting the way cookies are stored for captive portals.
Mm. Oh, I see. Okay. So, yeah, it's doable.
It's totally doable.
Yeah.
And the easiest way that I would see for someone to really take advantage of this would be to create a network that mimics a network people have very likely been on, like your local coffee shop.
Or airports.
Yeah, or airports. Sure, sure. And it doesn't even need to be exactly the same. It just needs to be a network that's named close enough that you think it's the right one. And you join it.
It could be. I mean, even just changing the name slightly means that you won't automatically join it, right?
Right.
And so, you know, it's not quite as trivial as that, but you're right. I mean, if you see something like, you know, Starbucks new, use this one, you might actually choose it. Seriously, right? Why wouldn't you, you know? I don't know. Maybe you wouldn't, but it's possible.
But many people would. Yeah.
But then, you know, at the same time, you know, the cookies that matter, aren't they being set over encrypted connections anyway?
Yes, but in this case, these cookies were stored in a way where they could be shared among different apps. And I think that's where the issue came in. So Apple changed how those cookies are stored, so now they're siloed.
Got it.
And then that just fixes the problem right there.
Sure. The potential problem.
The potential problem, yes, because there is no known exploit in the wild.
Right.
Even after 2.5 years.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, I mean, you'd have to engineer the exploit, which, as we talked about, doable. Not mm-hmm. terribly difficult, especially if you understand how to program cookies. And, you know, this is something we could do internally here at TMO, right?
Well, you bring up a good point, Dave. As well as Apple prioritizing the threats, so do the black hats. Yeah. They know what the easy channels are, and they know what the hard channels are. And why expend a lot of money for a small gain?
But just talking about this theoretically means we then have to identify the apps and the cookies that we want to spoof.
Yes.
And so there's a lot of time you'd have to invest in just watching traffic to figure out, okay, that's something that would be worth spoofing. Then you need to go build it. It's not like, all right, here's the problem. Go build something. No. Now you know the path you might be able to take. And again, if they're being sent, you know, all you need is for an app developer, all you need is some identifier in the cookie that makes it unique to you, and you're done. So,
an article the other day that Google is going to allow Android operating system to download apps from search results.
That seems...
what could possibly
what go could
wrong?
Go wrong?
This is something that Google... I mean, we tried this years ago, not in a mischievous way, but we were pushing apps and I think it was for one of our ad partners. We wanted to have an app download automatically after somebody clicked on something, right? It wasn't going to happen, you know, just in the background. It was going to be click on this to download the app. And Google was like, oh, no. You may not, you know. And now they'll allow that. That's
scary, man.
Yeah, but that's
what
happens.
At the time I went into the Aspen ski shop and asked for my skis to be tuned at 0 degrees. Yeah. I'll never forget. And he said, seriously? Scary, man.
That's like awesome. Hey, I'd love to keep talking about this, but there's another topic that I want to hit today as well. So I'm just going to have to move us along there, and we'll be left wondering exactly why it took Apple so long to patch the security.
Or if we merge our first topic into the second, did it take Apple long?
Wibbly wobbly, timey wimey. That's right. Okay, so the other thing that I wanted to hit today, John, you wrote a piece yesterday where the title is Everything You Need to Know About OLEDs, Quantum Dots, and iPhone, and it's part one of a series that you're doing, and I thought it was really interesting because, I mean, there's so much talk about televisions and resolution and 4K and UHD and all of this stuff. So you interviewed Paul Gagnon?
Gagnon.
Oh, Gagnon. And he's the director of TV research at IHS Technology.
That's right.
And so you had this really interesting interview with him. And my question is, why should I care about all of this technology?
Well, these are next generation display technologies. And as all the listeners and readers know, I am a 4K UHD nutcase and have been following 4K and Apple TV and displays and TV technology for years, just as I did when high def came along. And I become aware of something called quantum dots or nanocrystals in the discussion of 4K TVs. And then on the other hand, you continually hear about OLEDs. I used to call them OLEDs, organic light emitting diodes, but Paul corrected me and said the industry is pronouncing it OLED. And I mentioned that I thought it was like, okay, it's like Olaf. It's the two skiers, OLED and Olaf. So I started thinking about, well, if all the discussion is about OLEDs in the Apple next generation iPhones, what's the difference between these two technologies? What are the trade-offs? What are the brightness levels in the technology and amenability to, you know, pressure, 3D touch, and cost? Mm-hmm. So I had run across Paul in some previous discussions and email, and I asked him if he'd like to be interviewed. And so yesterday I published part one, today I'll publish part two. And he explained to me first about the technologies of quantum dots, which are basically liquid crystal technology, but they're much smaller, and they constrain the liquid crystal material, constrains the electrons to be physically constrained more so that when they excite, the wavelength is sharper. So you get crisper colors, you get a better color gamut, you get a narrow frequency range, and the colors look brighter and crisper. And also, quantum dots are able to generate a much brighter light. Normal TVs and our LCD displays are around 250 or 300 nits. That's metric abbreviation for candela per square meter, a measure of illumination. Whereas these quantum dots are able to generate 1,000 nits. And so that makes them amenable to high dynamic range, which is what we want on our 4K TVs. So that you can go vastly bright or vastly dark, and you get the HDR effect like we get on our phones when you're photographing shady areas in a bright sky. You see the details instead of things being washed out.
Does this also mean they use less power, John?
Well, that's the next issue. The power of quantum dots depends on what the background is. If it's mostly white, they use more power.
So it's a variable power consumption.
It is because of the way the technology works. And you have backlighting, and liquid crystals always depend on backlighting. And then to go black, you have to supply a current to the liquid crystal to make it block the light, and there's always some leakage. So that's why black levels in LCD technology have always been kind of an issue. The advantage of organic LEDs is they're self-illuminating. Diodes, they're organic material semiconductors.
Which also means thinner displays.
I don't know about thinness, but when you apply a current, they light up. And so there's no backlighting required. So I asked him about the relative power requirements, and when an organic LED is off, it's off, and you get pure, perfect black. And so the UHD Alliance has set up two different standards for two different kinds of TVs, OLEDs and quantum dots. Quantum dot TVs can be much brighter, but what's really important is the dynamic range, and I explain that in the article. So it's kind of an issue putting quantum dots on displays for computers, because most of our displays are browsers, which if you look at Mac Observer, is mostly white background with text. If you look at a Excel spreadsheet, it's mostly white background with text. And so quantum dots have a disadvantage in that respect compared to OLEDs. And then there's the cost issue. quantum dots are not very expensive. It's only about 20% more than the previous generation LCDs, and the cost difference is coming down. Mm-hmm. So at CES, there was a big coming out party for quantum dots, and you'll be able to buy TVs for not much more of a cost premium, whereas OLEDs are still very expensive for TVs, $10,000 for a 50 or 60 inch. So then the question is, how much more expensive are OLEDs for, say, a small display? And I'll go into that in part two today, where awesome. LEDs have their advantages for small devices, and they're not that much more expensive for, say, a 5-inch screen as opposed to a 65-inch screen.
So on our iPhones, we might just see these sooner than we will in our living rooms, cost being equal.
Yes. So I'll go into more details today about the applicability of these two technologies for phones and integration with 3D touch and power consumption and cost.
Awesome.
Have you bought your Quantum Dots television yet, John?
I'm waiting for a Quantum Dot 4K TV that has good HDR, adheres to the UHD Alliance premium sticker, which then I understand which kind of HDR technology is using, hopefully Dolby Vision or something that's standard that the content creators are using, that the Blu-ray, UHD Blu-ray are all by, will use, and that is also something that can be used with streaming. So all these things have to come together, and I'll be exploring this in 2016. And then we'll see where Apple fits in.
Cool.
All right. Well, we are out of time. So I'll just say, everyone, you need to go check out John's article, because it's really interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing part two today, John.
Excellent.
So with that, hey, Dave, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Yeah, loads of fun. And John, thank you for being here today.
Your quantum friend.
That's right. And listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll see everyone again tomorrow.